Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is a three-part series, and today's program is part one, New Perspectives in the Treatment of Advanced Skin Cancer, Basal Cell and Squamous Cell Cancers. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have 722 participants on the call from all of the United States, and we have international participants from the Philippines, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program was supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, a grant from Genentech, an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Alan Ho. Dr. Ho is medical oncologist, Department of Medicine, Head and Neck Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ho is going to present an overview of advanced skin cancers, including advanced basal cell cancers and advanced squamous cell cancers. He's going to address the standard of care, new treatment approaches, the emerging role of targeted therapy, and clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Ho.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thank you all for joining us on the call. And so, you know, in the next 15 minutes, I'll be covering all the topics that you just heard about. I guess what I'd like to start by doing is just kind of defining the terms of the disease entity that we'll be addressing today. So, as I'm sure many of you know, skin cancers represent some of the most common cancers that occur. The topic for today really has nothing to do with melanoma skin cancers, but the more common forms, which are squamous cell cancers and basal cell cancers. The vast majority of patients that have these non-melanoma skin cancers, as they're also termed, are readily cured by having the cancers themselves simply removed from the skin. What is more difficult to define is what we would consider advanced basal cell cancers or advanced squamous cell cancers, because indeed many people and different professionals refer to those terms in different ways. In my view, advanced basal cell and advanced squamous cell cancers, and mainly my view is that of a medical oncologist who utilize drugs to treat cancers, my view of advanced non-melanoma skin cancers are those that are not amenable to curative treatment with either surgery or resection or with radiation therapy. So with those parameters, we're really talking about very advanced skin cancers that have to be treated with chemotherapy or with drug therapy. Now, as you can imagine, that group of patients with advanced skin cancers that can't be treated either with surgery or that can't be cured with either surgery or radiation is quite a small population of patients. And so while basal cell and squamous cell skin cancers is quite a common disease, those with advanced skin cancers is actually quite a rare entity. We only see that more so in the context of academic large medical centers. So what we'd like to talk about today is how we approach these cancers, how we think about these cancers, and also what experimental or clinical trials may be considered for those tumors. So, with regards to what we refer to as standard of care for these diseases, we really don't have treatments that fit into the category of standard because of how rare these diseases are. And we have to take each disease kind of separately because, indeed, even though they both arise on the skin, biologically and clinically, they behave quite differently. So for advanced squamous cell cancers, and again, in terms of advanced, beyond just not being able to be cured with surgery or radiation, what that often means is a cancer that's on the skin that recurs repeatedly or comes back repeatedly despite having surgery, despite having radiation, or a cancer that metastasizes, meaning moves from its primary location to another location, whether it be a lymph node or whether it be the lungs or the liver or the bone. In those situations, oftentimes, the cancers can't be necessarily cured. And what that means is none of the treatment modalities that we have a high likelihood of eliminating all evidence of cancer completely so that it never comes back again. In those situations, you can often use chemotherapy or drug therapy to treat these patients. And in the case of advanced squamous cell cancers, because the drugs that are available or the drugs that one would use are very much determined not only from where the cancer arose, but the kind of cancer you're talking about. And so we use different drugs for squamous cell cancers that we use for basal cell cancers, et cetera, et cetera. So for advanced squamous cell cancers, we often do extrapolate from our experience with other diseases that under the microscope look like squamous cell cancers of the skin. And as was mentioned in the beginning, I'm actually an oncologist on the head and neck service, and the reason why as a head and neck oncologist I treat squamous cell cancers of the skin is because in the head and neck regions, the cancers that arise there and specifically include the throat or the tonsil or the tongue are also squamous cell cancers. They just arise in different places, first in the head and neck area versus on the skin. So because of that, there is an assumption that squamous cell cancers of the skin can respond to many of the same drugs or chemotherapies that we use in head and neck cancers. And there, the activity of these drugs or the effectiveness of these drugs are really much more better defined because it's a more common disease where clinical trials have been done to show how these drugs work. And so some of the standard cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs that are used for squamous cell cancer of the skin extrapolated from the head and neck experience could include something like a drug called cisplatin or a drug called Taxol or 5-fluorouracil. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that no trials have ever been done in squamous cell cancers. Indeed, there have been some showing some efficacy with cisplatin in small pilot trials, et cetera, or other targeted drugs, which I'll get to in a minute. But there are really small studies that are not really sufficient to get these drugs approved for use in skin in squamous cell cancers of the skin. But still, those trials, as well as our extrapolations from the head and neck cancer experience, are really what guide how we choose the drugs we want to use and what we think may be effective for these patients. So I just listed off some of the cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs. These are more traditional chemotherapy drugs that were developed over the last couple of decades, used in many other malignancies, et cetera. A term that many of you may have heard of are targeted treatments or targeted therapies, and these really refer to the newer generation of drugs that have been developed over the last decade or so, and they really target the tumors in ways that are different from traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Specifically, most of these drugs will target specific proteins on the cancer cells that are thought to be important for cancer cell proliferation and growth. And by blocking the signals from these proteins or somehow manipulating these proteins, the presumption is that you interfere with the cancer cell's ability to grow or divide, and that translates into tumor regressions or responses. So the targeted therapy that has been evaluated most recently for squamous cell cancers are these antibodies that target a molecule called EGFR. EGFR is an abbreviation that stands for epidermal growth factor receptor. And to simplify that, EGFR is one of the many proteins that sits on the outside part of the cancer cell, and that when stimulated can promote tumor cell proliferation, growth, and survival. Now, it's not entirely clear how these antibodies specifically work against cancers, but the drugs cetuximab and panitumumab, which are approved in other cancers, such as a colon cancer, these are antibodies that recognize and bind EGFR on the surface of tumor cells and either work by blocking the signals that come from EGFR to the cancer cell or by recruiting an immune response to these cancer cells. Exactly how these antibodies work and which one of those mechanisms is most important is really not clear. But what's interesting about these two agents is that more recently, two phase two trials have actually been done using these agents in advanced squamous cell cancers, both of which have shown that these drugs, in fact, can shrink advanced squamous cell cancer tumors in about 30% of patients or so. So we know that these drugs, which are FDA approved for other indications, can potentially work against squamous cell cancers of the skin. The other thing that we're trying to do, not only for squamous cell cancers, but basal cell cancers, is to learn more about the biologic profile of these tumors. And one of the ways to do that in a research setting, excuse me, is to look at the genetics of each of the tumors. And what you find is, because both of these cancers can be related to UV-induced DNA damage, that there are a lot of mutations or DNA changes that occur in these tumors. Sometimes this suggests experimental approaches that can be used to treat these cancers. But other times, it just suggests to us that a lot of DNA damage exists in these tumors, and it's harder to define what those experimental options may be. So in terms of targeted treatments for squamous cell cancers, EGFR targeting is really what's been done most recently. I'll move on to basal cell cancers and targeted treatment approaches where there have been more FDA-approved drugs there than in squamous cell cancers. And then at the end, I'll speak about clinical trials more and the concept of genomic profiling. So basal cell cancers, as I mentioned, even though they arise in the skin as well, are biologically and clinically different from squamous cell cancers. And one important way that they're biologically different is the vast majority of them are driven by a biologic pathway that's now been very well delineated, which we call the Hedgehog's signaling pathway. We know that in most basal cell cancers, this pathway is activated, and that if you inhibit that pathway, you can induce responses or regressions in tumors. One of the great achievements over the last several years has been the development of a set of drugs that inhibit the Hedgehog signaling pathway and have been proven to be effective for shrinking basal cell cancers for patients with advanced basal cell tumors. This has now led to the FDA approval of two drugs to be used specifically in advanced basal cell cancers. The first drug is called vismodegib, and the second drug is called sonitegib. I'm not going to talk about each one individually because, in essence, mechanistically, in terms of the way that they combat or act at the basal cell cancers, they're both quite similar. They inhibit a protein called smoothin, another one of these proteins on the surface of the cell that is critical for hedgehog pathway signaling. So by inhibiting smoothin and hedgehog pathway signaling, tumor regressions can occur in these patients. These are oral drugs that patients take, and they can take continuously on a daily basis and have to be maintained on these treatments in order to see the benefits of tumor regressions with basal cell cancers. Ultimately, approximately half of the patients with locally advanced basal cell cancers, that means cancers that are limited to the skin or even on the lymph nodes, can have some major responses to these drugs. The percentage of responses in patients with distant metastases, meaning that the tumor had moved to different organs like the lungs or liver or bone, it can still be effective in those situations, but the rates of response are lower. The challenge with these drugs is not only ensuring that patients respond, but also dealing with the side effects and toxicities. And I'll let Dr. Lacouture kind of discuss some of those things. There are very unique toxicities associated with those drugs, as well as with the EGFR inhibitors I spoke about a moment ago, but also unique interventions that dermatologists like Dr. Lacouture has helped us deal with. So in advanced basal cell cancers, even though a rare disease, it's a great example of how our understanding of the biology of that tumor has led to the development of novel therapeutics and new treatment options for those patients. The last thing I want to speak to you about are clinical trials, because certainly is true for not only advanced basal cell and squamous cell cancers of the skin, but also all advanced cancers, that we need to continually move the ball and develop new treatments in these areas. Ultimately, even though we can discover effective treatments for these advanced diseases, because they're not curative treatments, we as oncologists are always working to ensure that patients have as many treatment options as possible available to them. Because ultimately, even though a treatment can work for a time, after a specific period of time, the tumors may grow resistant, or a patient may grow intolerant of that therapy. And you always want to have other treatment options available for your patients. Clinical trials represent one way to expand patients' options, particularly those with these kinds of rare diseases. The clinical trial, the point of clinical trials is really to test the safety and effectiveness of new drugs in specific tumor indications. There are three categories of these clinical trials that I'll end with in my view. One is having a clinical trial that accepts patients with tumors irregardless of a marker. And what I mean by that is in some trials, you only need to have an advanced cancer to be enrolled. In other trials, you only need to have skin cancer or skin basal cell cancers to be enrolled. But beyond that, there is no marker within the tumor that is required. The second are these marker-driven trials, meaning that it's not important what kind of cancer you have, but that your cancer have a specific biologic marker, whether it be expression of a protein on the tumor cell that's detected in the pathology lab, or if you have the genetics of your tumor described, that your tumors have a specific DNA change or mutation that would predict your tumors may benefit from the drug that's being tested on a clinical trial. And so that's the second category of clinical trials. The last category of clinical trials that I would bring to you are these new sets of therapies now, which we call immunotherapies, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. This is a new exciting field in cancer where the drugs that are being developed don't act at the cancer directly, we think, but instead act to unleash or unlock the activity of your own immune system to battle the cancers. And there are many different experimental approaches being investigated about how to do that. But in recent years, there have been very exciting data showing how effective this can be in melanoma, and effective, but maybe less so in lung cancer, and has led to the FDA approval of several of these drugs for those indications. These drugs have yet to be formally tested in advanced basal cell cancers and advanced squamous cell cancers, so it's not clear how effective these drugs may be. And it's a set of drugs or a class of drugs that must just simply be tested in the cancers of interest for you to know how effective it is. There are no markers that we know of right now that can reliably predict whether or not a certain patient or tumor will respond. However, I think one of the reasons why this may be important for these cancers is because of all the mutations that these cancers hold. There is an active hypothesis now that tumors that have really high burdens of DNA changes or mutations may be more susceptible to these kinds of therapies. That's only a hypothesis right now, and what we need to do is test these therapies in these cancers and then correlate it back and see whether or not the burden of those DNA changes is really a marker for tumor response. So beyond some of the exciting developments for targeted treatments that have already been done, these types of clinical trials in those three categories are really going to be important to ensure that we're expanding treatment options for patients and hopefully develop new treatments and new therapies that may be available to them down the road.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ho. That was really outstanding, really an excellent, excellent presentation, a wonderful overview for everyone. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Really outstanding. Thank you so much. And really understandable. That's the most important. And I think that our participants really appreciate that so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Mario Lacatour. Dr. Lacatour is Director, Oncodermatology Program, Associate Attending Physician, Department of Dermatology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He also is the author of a book called A Skin Cancer Guide for People Living with Cancer, which is really very helpful and is a nice guide for all of you to have in terms of much of what Dr. Lacatour will be addressing in terms of care of your skin during treatment. So it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lacatour.
Thank you, Carolyn, and also thanks to everyone today listening to this cancer care program. My name is Dr. Mario Lacatour, and I have the privilege of working with Dr. Ho that very clearly described the new treatments that have been investigated and approved for the treatment of many advanced skin cancers. In terms of these therapies, oncologists work very, very hard to control these conditions through the use of these very new types of treatments. However, the use of these treatments is also associated with a variety of side effects that can affect the majority of people. Despite this, oncologists work very hard to try to minimize these side effects, either through interrupting the dose of these medications, using lower doses sometimes, or administering a variety of medications and treatments that can mitigate side effects that usually affect people's quality of life. The silver lining in all of this is that these treatments that oncologists have discovered and that are using these days are working so well that people in general are able to do many, many things in their normal life, and now they have to be concerned about many quality of life issues that fortunately many of them we can manage. Dr. Ho first talked about a certain class of drugs used for advanced squamous cell carcinomas known as the epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, or EGFR inhibitors for short. These drugs, when they are administered, they lead to an acneiform rash, or a rash that looks like acne affecting the face, the chest, and the scalp in the majority of patients. Thankfully, by using an antibody tablet that is taken daily at the beginning of therapy, and in some cases using a topical cream prescribed by your doctor, you can prevent the appearance of this rash or its severity. In addition to this, these drugs can also cause other side effects such as very dry skin, inflammation around the nails, the hair can become thin, and also people can develop itching in their skin. All of these untoward side effects can be treated by a dermatologist, by an oncologist, or by an oncology nurse. But it is very important for patients and people receiving these drugs to inform their oncologist about any side effect, and the earlier the better, because when, as with any other condition, the earlier you treat these side effects, or if possible, even prevent them, the more effective therapies are, and the more time and the greater the dose of the anti-cancer medication people will be able to stay on. Another common side effect of these drugs is that they cause sensitivity to the sun. So it's important for people to protect themselves against the sun by avoiding being outside in sunny areas between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. or through the use of sunscreen and protective clothing when being outside. Dr. Ho also mentioned a revolutionary class of new drugs called the hedgehog pathway or the smooth-end inhibitors that have been approved for the treatment of advanced basal cell carcinomas of the skin. These drugs are usually taken as a pill orally, and they can be associated with a variety of side effects. Most notably, they can cause cramping, and so people will report muscle cramps in their legs, in their abdomen, or in their arms that can be quite painful. But there are things that can be done to minimize this cramping. For example, it has been discovered that by taking medication orally that is usually taken for high blood pressure, a class of drugs known as calcium channel inhibitors, you are able to treat or prevent these painful cramps from the smooth-in inhibitors, such as vismodegib or sonidegib, which are the two drugs that have been approved. In addition, these drugs cause also a lot of weight loss, and they also, for a very unknown reason, cause alterations in the way people taste their food or liquids. So it's important for people receiving these drugs for advanced basal cell carcinomas to alter their diet. For example, it is thought that by adding more spice to their foods, by eating meats cooler, by using plastic utensils instead of metal utensils, and by sweetening drinks, one person receiving these therapies can taste them even better. And then, as with the EGFR inhibitors, we thought that with these smooth-in inhibitors, we would be able to overcome other side effects that were typical of traditional chemotherapy. The two most important ones that we see here that were also present with previous therapies are hair loss and diarrhea. So it turns out that with these drugs, you can develop not complete hair loss, but some degree of hair thinning. And this can be very problematic because people on these medications, thankfully because they work so well, will be on them for many, many years. So many people want to maintain their hair, and there are things that certain dermatologists that are familiar with these medications can do to stimulate hair growth in areas that where the hair has become thinner. There are also a variety of laboratory tests that may be taken also to see whether other factors in your body are contributing to your hair becoming thin. But the use of over-the-counter products, such as minoxidil, which was known as Rogaine, could be effective in patients that are developing hair thinning even when they are receiving these therapies. In terms of diarrhea, it is also important to alter your diet, to avoid uncooked vegetables, very greasy foods, and to try to maintain a high caloric intake with foods that are easily digestible. Receiving advice from a nutritionist or a dietitian is key in being able to maintain your weight and a normal appetite during your treatment. It is important to note that the majority of people that develop diarrhea are really not receiving an ideal diet that can mitigate the number of times that people have to go to the bathroom. Also, your oncologist can prescribe many different medications to control diarrhea, including over-the-counter medications at doses that are higher than those that are included in the box, and other medications that are only available via a prescription that, interestingly, are also able to control diarrhea in the majority of people. And then finally, of course, it's important to notify your doctor if you are also feeling very weak from these treatments, as these treatments, for various reasons, sometimes can make people become so tired that people just want to stay indoors all day. And we know that physical activity, paradoxically, actually leads to people being less tired. So keeping or trying to keep regular physical activity is important, walking with your family, doing your hobbies, and maintaining a happy and active lifestyle are key so that fatigue does not predominate. If these things fail, there are medications in certain cases that your doctor, your oncologist, can prescribe that actually are a certain type of stimulants that have been tested in some clinical trials showing benefit in some patients. And these drugs basically are stimulants that allow people to resume their daily activities, perhaps going to work, interacting with their families, and doing their hobbies or other leisure activities. And then finally, in terms of side effects, Dr. Ho also mentioned these new drugs that represent a class of drugs known as immunotherapies. These drugs, some of which Dr. Ho mentioned, have been approved for other skin cancers such as melanoma, but also have been approved in lung cancers and renal cell or cancers of the kidney, have shown impressive benefits by actually stimulating a person's immune system to attack cancer cells. What is interesting about these drugs is that they tend to lead to side effects that are very similar to autoimmune diseases that people would spontaneously have. For example, they lead to an inflammation of certain glands inside the body, for example, the thyroid or the pituitary gland. And these changes are usually manifested in people by people feeling very tired, lethargic, and not being able to do a lot of things, or going to the or a lot of urination is also common. The presence of these side effects with these immunotherapies can usually be diagnosed by your oncologist through laboratory tests from your blood. And also, thankfully, oncologists have found solutions for the majority of these that include replacement of those hormones that are altered. Immunotherapies can also lead to diarrhea. In this case, the diarrhea appears to be different. Essentially, these medications stimulate people's body to inflame their intestines. So, oncologists will resort to administering oral anti-inflammatory drugs called corticosteroids, which will, in the majority of cases, resolve this inflammation of the intestines and diarrhea. And then finally, skin problems have also been reported in patients receiving these drugs, usually in the form of rashes and very severe itching, all of which can usually be controlled with the use of creams containing medications against itch, such as corticosteroids or anti-itch medications, or antihistamine or anti-allergy tablets can also be taken. It's important, however, if you receive any of these medications, to maintain your skin in an optimal way, because it is estimated that up to half of people that are diagnosed with cancer will have some type of skin condition even before they start their treatment. These skin conditions include dry skin, itching, or skin infections in the form of bacterial skin infections or infections of the toenails of the feet with fungus. So if you are going to be starting a drug that leads to a high number of skin issues, it would be advisable for you to see a dermatologist even prior to starting your therapy so that your skin is placed in the optimal shape to receive these therapies, and so that these possible side effects may interfere with your life in the least way possible. It is also important to communicate with your oncologist and your oncology nurses whenever you develop a side effect, because as was discussed before, whenever you develop a side effect, the earlier that it is treated, the better the outcome will be. Please do not hesitate in contacting your oncologist or your oncology nurse, even if your appointment is not, your follow-up appointments are not set for another 2 or 4 weeks. call your oncologist before and let them know what is happening. Oncologists are remarkable for always looking for the best treatments for you and finding better solutions for your care and for your life, and they will find a way to improve whatever symptom it is that you're having, and therefore maintaining your lives in the best quality possible, and of course ensuring that you receive the maximum benefit from your treatment. I find it particularly useful when I see patients that they come usually with a partner or a spouse, and the partner or the spouse will come with a calendar. And in the calendar, they will write at what date they started feeling any side effect and what was taken for that particular side effect and what the outcome was. Because that way, it makes it much easier for your doctor to see what other treatments they can give you if the side effect persists, or if the side effect happens again later on, we will know what medication or what intervention to conduct so that that effect can be improved. And also, it is understandable that with so many things going on, it is difficult to remember what medication you took on what day, or if you're applying a certain cream for a skin problem, which cream was applied where. So I find it very useful when I see people and they have this written in a calendar, this will be very helpful not only for you but for your doctor. And it will help your doctor and your family do what we are all interested in, which is to improve your life and to keep your life in the best way possible. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. LeCouture. That was really excellent, also very outstanding and very comprehensive in terms of all the different tips that you provided for everyone to manage their lives so they can get on with their lives. And thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker, and she's Cancer Care's Older Adult Program Coordinator. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the free psychosocial services and programs that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Mester, and I'd like to thank everyone on the call today. It's been a wonderful call. We've gotten a lot of good information. We've been talking today about the various treatments that are out there, new developments, managing some of the side effects, and those types of things, really managing your care and your quality of life. And what I'd like to talk about now is how creating a support network as part of that care can improve your quality of life and how cancer care can be a part of that network. So a little bit about us. We're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and then over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York and over the phone nationally and online, actually both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and as I said before, they're completely free of charge. Oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so the support network. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and overall psychological impact and care. And I find that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in all of the areas I just mentioned is an important part of the healing process, and I actually consider it to be a treatment. It's part of treatment. As you know, cancer affects the whole person and really the whole family and friends, the whole support network. I really want you to know, however you're affected by cancer, you do not have to do this alone. You don't have to walk the path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar problems. Individual counseling really gives you a space that's just yours to voice the concerns that are coming up and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And these connections, I feel they help lessen the isolation that often comes with a cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment, whether you're the patient or a caregiver or loved one. So at this time, we are offering a multitude of support groups. We have our online support group program, which is very comprehensive. We are currently running, and I hope I have this number right, 54 different online support groups. So I recommend checking into our website for that. You just go to www.cancercare.org. And actually, our website is very comprehensive. You can find out not only about the support groups, but all of our support services, our publications are on there. There's also just a lot of good information about your diagnosis and treatment, those types of things. So that's the online support group program. We're also offering telephone support groups at this time, and face-to-face support groups for people who are in the New York area. Again, it really is about not walking the path alone and, you know, being able to connect to others who may be going through something similar and get it in that way. If you're interested in any of our services, please call us at our Hope Line, which is 1-800-813-HOPE, or, as I said before, visit our website, www.cancercare.org. You know, we've learned a lot from today's program. It's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Just know that we're here to help you understand what it means for you and your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshop or services, don't hesitate to contact us. And again, please remember you're not alone in this. Our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Well, thanks so much, Ms. Kelly. That was really excellent, really very engaging in terms of all the different services that everyone can access from Cancer Care for free. And now we have time for questions. I want to thank our speakers. We have lots of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board so that they can answer your questions. And she's going to explain to you all how to queue up for questions so that you can go ahead and ask your questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question at the end of the call, I will explain to everybody how you can get your questions answered. But for now, let's see if we can't take them all. Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star one.
And we have a question from one of our online participants. It's really, the question is from Mary. Would like information about basal cell skin cancer and the likelihood of recurrence. So Dr. Ho, could you address that just in terms of there's some way to just give some information about, in a general way, about the tendency for these to recur, or if you could say a little bit about that, Dr. Ho.
Yeah. As I mentioned in the beginning, I think it's important to realize that even though we're talking about treatments for advanced basal cell cancers or squamous cell cancers, this is an extremely rare type of situation. So oftentimes, if you have a basal cell cancer that's easily removed by your dermatologist or by a surgeon, there's the likelihood that that will recur in that same area is extremely low. What is a more common situation is that patients who have basal cell cancers can maybe potentially have another basal cell cancer that arises in a different place, but is still eminently curable by a simple resection. It's an interesting question about how patients with in the rarer situations of recurrent basal cell cancers or basal cell cancers that are not amenable to cure with surgery or radiation, what makes those tumors different? I think that's something that deserves some investigation. I will say that enriched in these patients with difficult-to-treat basal cell or squamous cell cancers are those that are chronically immune-suppressed, meaning we have a population of patients that have like another type of bloodborne cancer like CLL who are chronically immune-suppressed and they have more difficult-to-treat cancers. Now, even in that situation, for CLL patients, this is a rare situation. Or more commonly, in patients who are purposely on immunosuppression, immunosuppressive drugs, such as those who have received an organ transplant, where these drugs are required to keep their immune system in check so that they can accept and keep their transplanted organ. Again, we see higher rates of complicated or more difficult to treat advanced skin cancers in that patient population. So we, at least we have those kind of clinical correlations, which interestingly also provide the proof of principle that immune surveillance for patients is one critical mechanism by which our bodies probably surveil and keep at bay the initiation or the start of skin cancers. And that when you take away that immune surveillance with immunosuppressive drugs, you're more predisposed to these types of malignancies. But overall, for the general population, without these kind of rare mitigating factors, recurrence after resection is quite uncommon.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And our next question comes from. From Ellen, I was recently diagnosed and have upcoming summer vacation plans. How can I prepare? So, and Dr. Lakatora, would you want to address just the care of the skin and the sun? And
yes. Well, I'm glad that you are about to set on a vacation, and we all hope that you enjoy it very much. In terms of protecting yourself, there are several different things that I think are most important in cancer patients and survivors. As a dermatologist, of course, I have to say that the skin is very important, and especially in sunny locations, one must try to protect oneself and your family from the sun. So avoid going unprotected between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Whenever going outside at those times, it is recommended to use protective clothing, so long sleeved shirts or shorts and pants, a broad-brimmed hat, and sunglasses. It is interesting that now there are companies that sell products that have ultraviolet or sun protection that is included within the fabric, so that you don't really have to keep applying sunscreen very frequently. And many people like this because they feel more comfortable and they don't have to worry about applying sunscreen all the time. Now, if you do not, if you would not like to purchase this clothing, you can obtain a detergent called Rit SunGuard, which you actually put it in your washing machine, and it'll make your clothes, your summer clothes, UV resistant for up to, I believe it's about 20 washes. So this is another option for people who do not want to keep applying sunscreen when they go outside. And then in terms of sunscreen, and it's recommended to use a sunscreen of a sun protection factor or SPF of at least 15 or 30. Above that number, there is really no significant difference. What makes a difference is using it properly. It is estimated that only about a third of people use sunscreen properly because they don't apply enough or they do not apply it frequently enough. So what is enough sunscreen? Well, what is recommended by the American Academy of Dermatology, which is the largest organization of dermatologists that I am a part of, is that for your entire body, you should use an ounce of sunscreen every time you apply it. So that is an ounce is the amount that would be similar to that of a golf ball or a small shot glass. You should apply that to your entire body, and also it is recommended that you apply sunscreen every 2 hours when exposed to the sun or every hour if swimming or sweating. Also, it's important to remember that there are certain parts of the body that may require more frequent application and are more sensitive to skin cancers. For example, men that have lost their hair, their scalp is very susceptible to developing skin cancers. The majority of basal cell carcinomas, even the advanced ones or the ones that are more difficult to treat, will usually occur in the face and upper body. So those areas are very important to have them covered. And remember that for those of you that have children, that much of the sun damage that occurs in people are when they were young, so it's important also to protect your children. And then finally, the other part that I think is very important when you're going on vacation, depending on where you go, is to try to maintain a balanced diet, to drink filtered water, depending on where you go to, and also to avoid substances or drinks that are irritating to your stomach. So too much caffeine, too much alcohol are not recommended, so that diarrhea can and stomach upset can be minimized.
Excellent. Thank you. That's very informative. And actually, can you spell the name of the detergent so people are listening? That's probably an important thing for people to hear.
Yes, the detergent that you can add to the dishwasher, to the washing machine for your clothes is called Ritz SunGuard, R-I-T SunGuard. So you may find that at certain drugstores, or you can also, I'm sure, get it online.
Excellent, thank you. And we'll include that as a resource to people as well. That's excellent, okay. And then we have another question here. From Joseph, what is actinic keratosis and what does it look like? Dr. Rakator, would you address that one?
Yes, I can address it if Dr. Hoke would like to add something, of course. So actinic keratoses are what we consider to be precancerous skin spots. So they usually present at these red, rough, scaly little spots in the skin are usually present on the head or the arms or chest or upper back, so sun-exposed areas, in very fair-skinned people. The important thing about actinic keratoses is that 1 out of 100 to 1 out of 1,000 will really go on to become, as what Dr. Ho mentioned, a squamous cell carcinoma. So the majority of these actinic keratoses can be treated locally by your dermatologist with either a cream or by using a device which will essentially burn the actinic keratoses off with the use of a very cold liquid.
And Dr. Ho, did you want to add anything to
No, I think that about covers it. They are pre-malignant lesions, so they themselves are not cancer, but have lower incidence have the potential to transform into cancer, as Dr. Lakator mentioned. And screening and treatment of those lesions, those pre-malignant lesions, certainly needs the attention of a dedicated dermatologist.
And then we have another question from one of our participants that in terms of starting treatment. I'm about to start treatment. How should I prepare for, as recently diagnosed and have upcoming summer vacation plans, how should I prepare for my treatment? And Dr. Ho, if you could address that.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Recently diagnosed with and doesn't say which type of skin cancer and have upcoming mm-hmm. summer plans, but how can I prepare actually mm-hmm. for, I guess, potential treatment?
Okay. I'm going to assume that the treatment being discussed here is some kind of oral or intravenous chemotherapy or drug therapy for an advanced tumor. And in terms of preparation, just speaking in general terms, I think as was alluded to in the other two talks, a big part of this is understanding and having correct expectations about what's about to happen. And I think in this regard, education in terms of potential benefits of the drug, but also the potential side effects and toxicities of the drugs, that you're being treated with are going to be important. And because once you hit set those expectations, you'll know what kind of interventions are going to be important for you to have on hand in case you experience any of those side effects, as well as what kind of precautions you might want to take depending upon what you're doing, whether it be going on vacation in the summer, et cetera. The other thing I would say is, just to echo the previous point, in my experience as a medical oncologist, having that support system, both personally at home, as well as knowing that you have access to your medical oncology nurses and doctors and office to help guide you through this, is critically important. Because in situations where toxicity, side effects, problems, or questions become more problematic, the vast majority of times it's because patients are left feeling alone or have not properly set up their personal care networks, for one reason or another, are not communicating those things to their medical team. And so communication is really key in terms of not only feeling prepared for the treatments, but also dealing with things that maybe you didn't prepare for, or dealing with issues that arise during treatment, and they always do. But if those lines of communication and those support networks are set up in a constructive way, patients are in a much better position to deal with problems or issues as they arise. So I think those are just some general considerations depending upon what treatments are being considered.
That's an excellent point. And Ms. Cole, do you want to comment on that as well, with the support groups and people coming here for help in terms of that, having that support network in place as well?
Absolutely. You know, I think the support network can give you that feeling of structure and stability and having a place to go to with things. And I loved what Dr. Ho just said, too, that you have your personal support network. You also have the medical team, and that is part of the support network as well. So for something like going on a vacation, because this is something that comes up all the time in group and also with individual work, you know, you want to, kind of going back to what Dr. Ho said, you know, have your expectations there, understand, have that education about your treatments and what that means for you. And, you know, I'm reminded here also, Dr. Lakatour talked about, you know, protecting yourself, being protected, whether it's sunscreen or the UV clothing. You basically, before you do anything or go on these vacations, you want to make sure that you just have a plan of action for things. You understand your treatment, your care, you've got your support network, you can connect with them, you can connect with a medical team if you need to. You know, I encourage people to continue living, to continue going on vacation and celebrating with their families, especially as we head into a warmer season. Again, it's just about having that knowledge and using that knowledge and your support network to help with that protection.
Thank you. Excellent. And we have one late-breaking question here before we conclude the call. Is spray-on sunscreen harmful due to the fact that it is airborne and easily inhaled, from Sandra? It's much easier to apply to kids, but is often stifling. I'm not sure. Dr. Gore, could you address that? It's an interesting question. No one's ever asked that before on these calls.
Yes, that's a great question. And Sandra, I think Sandra's right. We don't know if they are dangerous. We just know that they are probably not as effective as the ones that you apply as creams. However, that said, she's correct. It's very difficult to apply sunscreen on children, but they have sunscreen that they make and they use frequently in Australia that are colored sunscreens with nice bright colors. So kids love to apply these colors on them, so that is an option for kids. Protective clothing, again, there are these what they call rash guards, which are these shirts that long sleeve shirts that kids can go in the water with them and have sun protection in them. That's another option. But if those things are not available, certainly, the aerosols are not recommended, but they are better than no sunscreen at all.
Thank you, Sonia. Great question. This is a great audience. I have to say, we had wonderful questions today and wonderful speakers. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I also want to thank, actually, our participants on the call, those who've been listening, as well as those who've really queued up and asked such really great questions. Now, I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we know that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so with that being said, you may still have questions that you didn't have answered, or you may think of more questions that you'd like to have answered. And so for any of your questions that are medically focused, really that having to do with advanced basal cell or squamous cell cancers, or even in terms of protecting yourself in terms of the sun, any questions that you might have, I would definitely recommend you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, that's 1-800-422-6237. And for any of you who have questions about joining a support group or getting financial assistance from Cancer Care or having someone to talk to here or counseling or practical assistance or joining another one of these workshops, then you would simply call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. Now, I want to remind you this is part one of a three-part series, and the other two programs, and some of you may have colleagues or friends that you may want to refer this to, are on emerging treatments for metastatic melanoma on March 18th, and the role of immuno-oncology in the treatment of melanoma on April 1st. So for those of you who might have some interest in those topics, you're welcome, and some of you have already signed up for them. I just want to remind you of that. And most importantly, as we conclude, we don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer. We want you to know that you're now part of Cancer Care's world here and that you can call us at any time. We're here for you. I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.